Essential Classics.
Back tomorrow morning from 9:30.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
On 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, you're listening to BBC Radio 3. In this 500th anniversary year of the birth of the celebrated Italian composer Palestrina, the vocal group Stile Antico also happened to celebrate 20 years of singing together. And so now at 5 o'clock, let's join Hannah French.
Yes, welcome to the Early Music Show, your one-stop shop for music from Perrotin to Purcell, and today, Palestrina. The Kyrie from Palestrina's Messa Papa Macelli, sung by Stile Antico, and three members of the vocal group, tenor Benedict Hymas, soprano Rebecca Hickey and bass Gareth Thomas, join me today to talk more about the perennial muse that is Palestrina. Hello, thanks for stopping by, you three.
Hello.
Hi.
Now, Ben, we just heard from your recent Palestrina album, the final in the Golden Renaissance trilogy on the Decca label, and it's the Messa Papa Macelli. What a way to end.
Yeah, we wanted to finish the trilogy with something incredible like that. The Messa Papa Macelli has quite a reputation as perhaps even the piece that saved music. This is the apocryphal, perhaps, story about Palestrina, but it felt like a fitting way to finish the series.
So, saved music because?
Well, the Counter-Reformation was coming about around that time, and we'll talk more about that, but it's thought that he wrote this in such an incredible way with such style that suited this new Counter-Reformation idea, that perhaps that was the reason that the Council of Trent decided not to ban polyphony.
What a legacy, true or not. Gareth, Giovanni Pierluigi da Palestrina, named after the town of Palestrina. He moved to Rome, though, as a child, didn't he? And the city captured his heart, a Roman through and through.
It's hard to think of another composer sort of so associated with one city in particular. So yeah, as his name suggests, he was born in Palestrina, just outside Rome, and his first position as a director of music was in Palestrina itself. But pretty early on, in 1551, he went to the Cappella Giulia in papal service. That was his sort of big break, if you like. And then 1555, he became a member of the Cappella Sistina in papal service. He seems to have been appointed without the usual sort of formal examinations that the other singers and members of that chapel had to undergo, which was quite controversial at the time. Also, not least because he was married, and he actually fell foul of that rule pretty quickly when the new Pope, Pope Paul IV, came in and decided that he would uphold the rule that all the musicians had to be clerical, so celibacy was implied as part of that. And so he had to leave pretty quickly from that. He then found employment at St John the Lateran, the papal basilica just outside of Rome. And then in 1561 goes to Santa Maria Maggiore, where he had previously been a chorister.
Okay.
So he returns there. Then finally, 1571, again, different pope, different rules. He was allowed back into the Cappella Julia, even though he had remarried by this stage. And from then on, he stayed in papal service from then on to the end of his life in 1594.
Whistle Stop Tour, based in Rome. Thank you very much. Becky, it seems only fitting we should hear some of his music sung by the Sistine Chapel Choir. What's it to be?
It's going to be his very famous motet, Tuus Petrus, a very fitting piece for Rome. I mean, the text really is the crux of the whole of the Catholic Church, in which words from Matthew's Gospel, when Jesus commissions Peter to found his church. So it's obviously very significant.
Thank you.
Palestrina's Tuas Petrus, sung by the Sistine Chapel Choir. Gareth, as you were saying, Palestrina spent his professional life in Rome and formative years in the Papal Chapel. But who were his musical heroes there? Which music would he have sung?
Well, the rich musical tradition of the Sistine Chapel Choir was an incredible thing for him to be able to draw on. You had really famous figures like Josquin. He died in 1521 and had been in Rome earlier than that, but his music was being copied actually much later. 1545, there's a choir book with much older music in it.
Yeah.
So you've got people like Josquin, Arkadelt as well, composer we don't really hear of very much these days, but was hugely important in those days. You can also see it in the parody masses that he later wrote. That was obviously the most sincere form of flattery to parody a motet that you've written. So other papal composers like Cristobal de Morales, there's some fantastic Palestrina masses on his motets, and also Andreas de Silva. So, yeah, there is a rich vein of material that Palestrina can draw on, and he would have sung this music. It wasn't just, we think of composers as just composing. No, they were active musicians. And so he had a real wellspring of inspiration to draw on.
Thank you.
music, likely sung by Palestrina at the Sistine Chapel, Josquin Salve Regina, sung there by Stile Antico, three members of whom, Becky, Ben and Gareth, join me today on the Early Music Show to explore Palestrina's life and legacy. Now, the city of Rome is synonymous with Palestrina, but Becky, it was a magnet for many other composers at the time, wasn't it?
I mean, that's the centre of Catholicism. A lot of musicians went there, not just for the music making, though that was obviously, there was the pull of a salaried job as a singer in the papal chapels was probably very attractive in itself. But a lot of composers and singers went there for religious reasons. Mm. And there were quite a lot of movements being set up around that time, which were, you know, pretty fervent. For example, Victoria went to Rome to work, and he was probably attracted as much by the religious, you know, inspiration that he would derive from being there as for the musical reasons.
Yeah, it was in the air. I mean, this was the time of the Counter-Reformation, Ben, as you alluded to earlier, the Catholic revival in response to the Protestant Reformation, you know, a real period of spiritual and intellectual revitalisation. What effect did that have directly on Palestrina?
Well, I don't want to pour cold water on the idea that this Missa Papa Marcelli was the thing that saved music, but it's actually not particularly certain when that was composed. It may have actually been before the Council of Trent met. It's slightly out for debate, but I think it's quite clear that Palestrina wrote in a way that really ticked all the boxes for the Council of Trent's requirements of making text very clear, the use of homophony to simplify the music so that the communication of the text was good for the congregation.
It is notable that Missa Papa Marcelli is really striking compared to other six-voice masses of the time. It really does stand out. So whether or not this myth is true or not, there's obviously must be a grain of truth somewhere in the story.
Becky, I suppose Palestrina is capturing the spirit of the time, the spirit of the age with these works, but they weren't all necessarily intended for services. You know, as you said, that composers were drawn to Rome because of the environment that they would be working in on a broader sense. We're going to hear Palestrina's motet Nigra Sum next. Where would he have envisaged this being sung?
Well, as I mentioned, some religious movements in Rome at the time. One of them was those who followed Filippo Neri. And what he advocated, the use of Song of Songs in particular, and he was very keen on the idea of domestic devotion as well as devotion in, you know, the grand churches. And so it's quite likely that these settings might have been performed in people's homes, or people might have brought professional singers in to perform them in their homes or in other places. And it's true, when we sing these settings, they feel quite chambery and also extremely expressive. And the words, you know, sometimes they're quite naughty. And so that did give Palestrina a chance to be really sort of quite sensual and expressive with the text. And it's noticeable when you sing these things. And they're the kind of thing, they sound really good one to a part as well. They really work. They're sort of almost madrigalian, but with sacred text, but not overtly religious.
Palestrina did write some madrigals very early on in his career, which he then apologised for in the preface to the Song of Songs. And I think it's ironic that, yeah, the Song of Songs are far more expressive and sensuous pieces than any of these love madrigals that he wrote in his youth. And yet these are still sacred texts, but there's a kind of real fervency about the way he delivers the text.
I think he did still think of them as an allegory of Christ and the soul, but they're very colourful texts, as you say.
Yeah, I think he revelled in the fact he could walk the line between the sacred and secular.
That's the thing. I think the chromaticism in Nigra Sum, for example, is so developed and interesting and far more than you'd expect from someone who was, as you say, absolutely believing it as an allegory.
Thank you.
Nigrissum by Palestrina, sung by Stile Antico. I'm Hannah French. This is the Early Music Show on BBC Radio 3, shining the spotlight today on Palestrina, one of the leading composers of late 16th century Europe and an icon in the 21st century, especially for groups such as Stile Antico, who join me today. Becky, you've been singing that particular piece together for quite some time, haven't you?
Yes, we have. It was on our disc, Song of Songs, which is the first disc I did with the group, actually. But apparently we performed it at the York Early Music Festival Young Artist Competition 20 years or so ago. And it's been in the repertoire for all that time, actually. It's a firm favourite.
But thinking back to the history of the group, a little earlier than that, you hadn't quite settled on the name Stile Antico, right?
No, because we first got together as a group of students. And the first concert that we did was a concert of Victoria. So the first concert was done under the name The Victoria Singers. And we performed his Tenebrae responsories, amongst other things.
Well, it could have stuck. I like Stile Antico, but, you know, we're here for Victoria. In fact, we're coming to Victoria next. You mentioned him earlier because he was also drawn to Rome, younger Spanish contemporary of Palestrina, embracing that post-Counter-Reformation style.
Yeah, there's plenty of stories that say that Palestrina might have been Victoria's teacher. There's no sort of firm evidence for that, but I think it's highly likely they probably did meet in Rome. And certainly Palestrina's style is very evident in Victoria's own writing. Certainly when you compare Victoria to other Spanish composers, they're a bit more dense in their polyphony, whereas there's a clarity to Victoria which is very similar to Palestrina. But with Victoria you get a little bit more kind of Spanish vividness, a bit more gore maybe. I think that's very evident in the Tenebrae responses. But there's never a note wasted, again, like Palestrina.
Stile Antico with O Vos Omnes from Tomás Luis de Victoria's Tenebrae responsories. We're back to Palestrina now. And while he might have enjoyed professional success, Ben, he had something of a tragic personal life, didn't he?
Yeah, he was, I think it was mid-40s. He had was met with extraordinary tragedy around a plague which took the life of his wife and two of his sons. It's hard to believe that he could continue writing at all at this stage, but some of the most incredible music did come out of that period. There's one piece which we'll play called Peccantum Mei Quotidie, which we discovered recently in a new programme we put together, which we almost couldn't believe was by Palestrina for its expressivity and depth and darkness.
Because it's, you know, I have sinned, and then, you know, I'm frightened of death. And then at the very end he says, you know, Lord, save me. When you sing it, it feels actually quite devastating. It's got some incredible parts in it which you just think, wow.
Yeah, the vocal ranges are quite big, aren't they? There's the Quiar in Inferno, down into the depths, really, everyone's down in their bootstraps. But then for the Miserere, real cry of help over an octave higher, which big ranges for Renaissance music.
Mm. Yeah, perhaps it reveals something more about his personality that we didn't really know. We sort of think of him as this clean, perfect composer, and perhaps a bit bland. It's not uncommon that we musicians sometimes think of him as a little bit boring until we actually explored his repertoire and found some of these pieces which aren't so commonly done, such as this. Perhaps it says more about his personality. There was more depth than we thought. Certainly the writing suggests that.
Thank you.
Depths of Despair in Palestrina's Peccantum Mei Quotidie, written in the year his eldest son died. It was sung there by the 16, conducted by Harry Christophers. Palestrina considered taking holy orders around this time, but Becky, life took him in a different direction.
Yes, so instead of taking holy orders, he in fact remarried, and he remarried a widow of a furrier, and he helped with her business, and I think there was quite a bit of money there, and it possibly helped him to publish some more of his music. So, you know, I think his fortunes took a turn for the better.
Yeah, almost a newfound independence.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, he was almost able to go freelance. I don't think there are many other composers who were able to publish as much as he was because it cost money. But he was in the unusual position of having some financial security.
Incredible. Well, we're going to hear his Exaltati Deo next. Becky, one of your favourites?
Yeah, I absolutely love this piece. It's just so joyous to sing. And it's just lovely what he's done with illustrating all the different instruments. Because, I mean, the text from Psalm 81 is, you know, full of praising God with different instruments. And it's obviously a subject very close to his heart. And it's really joyous.
Yeah.
It's got a real contrast to Peccante Mei Quotidie. It's just incredibly cheerful.
Change in fortune.
Yeah.
The Cambridge Singers with Palestrina's jubilant Exaltati Deo in praise of music. Well, we're fast approaching the end of this Palestrina early music show, but I still have three members of Stile Antico here in the studio, Becky, Ben and Gareth. It would be great to reflect on the great man's legacy. We'll come back to the Missa Papamacelli in a moment, but first, Gareth, he has a reputation for perfecting the style of music from which you take your name, Stile Antico.
As a group, we're incredibly democratic. We all take the decisions on everything. No one voice dominates in the same way that in the Stile Antico, every voice is equal. And Palestrina is held up as the greatest example of that. And I've been trying to think, why is that? What is it that makes him the one that we all try to follow? And I think it boils down to the sort of the clarity, particularly of the text setting. We talked about how he was so involved in the Counter-Reformation movement, and it's the way that the music hangs on the text, as opposed to the text hanging on the music, I think. Mm. If you think of it about he's providing music for that text rather than text to the music, that's the thing that I think makes it such a great example of what he's trying to do.
And Becky, for all those reasons, Palestrina must have been a hard act to follow.
Yes, he must have been. He had this immense reputation, didn't he?
Yeah.
But one of the very famous composers who followed him was Allegri, and he was a big fan of Palestrina. In fact, he studied his music under Nannini, who was a close friend of Palestrina. So he was very influenced by him. And he sang in the Sistine Chapel Choir. I know we all know him for his Miserere, but he's about a lot more than that.
And Ben, you've chosen a recording of Allegri from King's College London, conducted by David Trendall.
Yeah, we're very fond of David. He died 10 years ago, sadly, but it was a great inspiration for us. He knew a lot about his Renaissance music, and his ideas and his conducting and his leadership, actually, I think we've absorbed those ideas, and they come up quite regularly while we're rehearsing and talking about things. He's a big figure in the background for some of us.
For all that he was incredibly intelligent and academic and knew everything about music, he would approach it with just pure musicality and just serving the music, doing what the music says, and not thinking, well, this is a piece of early music, we've got to sing it in a certain way. He was all for sort of full-blooded emoting in the music.
David Trendall conducted the choir of King's College London in Allegri's Christus Resurgens. Thank you, Becky Hickey, Ben Hymas and Gareth Thomas of Stile Antico for sharing your passion for Palestrina today on The Early Music Show. We're going to end with more from your latest release of his sacred music, at the heart of which is the Missa Papamacelli, and at the heart of that, the Credo. Well, however much is true in the legend of this pure mass saving sacred polyphony from oblivion at the Council of Trent, you've shown me again today how pivotal it was in the music of the Counter-Reformation. But what for you makes it so special to sing, Gareth, first?
I think there's an incredible kind of internal energy and sort of momentum that we've talked about, how we set texts so sensitively and clearly. And as a result, it's very easy to shape and phrase as a singer. It's because it's all just there in the score for you. So it's very satisfying to sing.
Yeah, and some credos feel like, you know, like a shopping list a bit. There is a flow to it as well, and there's some really sort of mellifluous things to sing. But there's a lot of homophonic passages as well. It's quite varied, I think. Mm. That's partly why I like it.
Yeah, he does extraordinary things throughout. But we all really love the end of this eight-minute piece, movement, I should say, where the baritones lead us into this cascading amen, where there's the voices are overlapping, the crescendo is rising, and it's a really amazing ending.
Thank you.
The Credo from Palestrina's Missa Pape Marcelli, performed by Stile Antico on their latest recording of the composer's music in his 500th anniversary year of his birth. The Early Music Show was presented by Hannah French, and it was produced in Salford by Ben Collingwood. Next Sunday, Hannah delves into the life and music of the Flemish composer and publisher Tielman Suzzato, who was working in Antwerp in the mid-16th century. That's at the usual time of 5 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Next this evening, we'll be exploring themes of selfless love and sacrifice as we join Georgia Mann for Words and Music after this.
This Classical Life on BBC Radio 3. Join me, Jess Gillam, and a new guest each week as we chat about the music we love and why.
It's very dance-like, and to perform it on stage is very unlike any other piece that I've played before, and I always find that the orchestra, they really enjoy that moment on stage.
In the next episode, I share music with pianist Jennifer Canet-Mason, who made her BBC Proms debut when she was just 19.
You have to be very, very fit to play a piece like this, and there's so much to absorb.
This Classical Life with Jennifer Canet-Mason. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Over on our new BBC Sounds music stream, Radio 3 Unwind, now it's Classical Wind Down. And to listen, just search for Radio 3 Unwind on BBC Sounds. Here on Radio 3, our Sunday feature at 7:15 uncovers a little-known story from 500 years ago about a woman who chose to run away from the world by bricking herself into a tiny cell for life in the middle of a busy Dutch city. Suster Bertiken is after today's Words and Music with Georgia Mann.
Hello. From Tinkerbell saving Peter Pan by drinking his poisoned medicine, to soldiers giving up their lives on the battlefields, today's Words and Music explores themes of selfless love and sacrifice. For centuries, writers and composers have been inspired by biblical examples of selfless love, from the Lamb of God, Agnus Dei, to King David pleading that he die in place of his son. And the crucifixion becomes a metaphor in Oscar Wilde's The Happy Prince and Benjamin Britten's Corpus Christi Carol. Families make everyday sacrifices, giving up their wages in Noel Stretfield's Ballet Shoes. Elsewhere, Iphigenia is sacrificed to the gods in Gluck's opera about the Trojan War, while the boys in Lord of the Flies plan a much darker sacrifice. And in Kazuo Ishiguro's futuristic novel Never Let Me Go, three young friends who were bred to be organ donors contemplate their approaching deaths. Our readers are Pearl Mackey and Matthew Tennyson, and in an archive recording, John Gielgud reads a letter from a young RAF pilot to his mother. But we start with the sea and Sinbad's ship from Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade and the act of selfless love that launches the tales of the 1001 Nights.
King Sharia made it his custom to take a virgin in marriage to his bed each night and kill her the next morning. This he continued to do for 3 years until a clamour rose among the people, some of whom fled the country with their daughters. At last came the day when the vizier roamed the city in search of a virgin for the king and could find none. Dreading the king's anger, he returned to his house with a heavy heart.